If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
But four gray walls staring at me. The policeman said to me, son, they won't build no schools anymore. All they build will be prison, prison. They won't build no schools anymore. All they build will be prison.
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We're here with Takuma Jackson, with the Mary Kiona Foundation and other projects too. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Right on. Thanks so much for joining us. And I know we got a lot of things to talk about in a short period of time. Can you start off by telling us your general kind of experience getting involved with work, helping people inside and doing it inside and outside?
My story may differ from others, but being this is a prison pipeline, I'm sure there's some familiarities there. Of course, I started this work upon my incarceration. When I was first in prison back in May of 2000, I pretty much didn't have a clue what I was going to get involved in or how I was going to do this time. I came down with about 34 years and pretty much, you know, head in the clouds and, you know, an angry man, you know, I mean, I was all over the place. Just had no clue what direction I was going to go in. So for the first 10 years, I was pretty much just running around aimlessly, trying to be a part of this, part of that, end of this, end of that, had no program. I seen no light at the end of the tunnel. It was just that I'm doing 34 years, this is what it is. And everything was, it was repetitive, evolving to, from 2000 to 2013 was repetitive. It was the same thought process, the in and out of the hole. Just not caring about what's gonna happen in the end, because, you know, at this point I was getting out at the age of 59. So I pretty much said, hey, my life is over. So, you know, what's the purpose? You know, but in 2013, I had got transferred to Oregon State Prison. And that was, I guess, it was a significant change. The atmosphere was totally different from where I was from. You know, I was out there in Snake River, so it was pretty much moving like cattle, you know, being prodded through the crowd and, you know, and stand here, go that way, move to the right, fix your pants, and that's pretty much was the routine. Settle in, go to chow, come back, bam. When I got to OSP, it was like a small functioning city. I mean, I didn't know there were supporters then, but I seen people coming in. I've seen tours, college kids tours. I've seen different organizations coming through. It was just this flow of activity as it was just, you know, just a lot going on. I seen guys walking to the superintendent hey, superintendent, let me talk to you for a minute. Hey, captain. And there was just this pro-social atmosphere that I just wasn't used to. So here I am from one institution to another, and here I am automatic. I'm culture shocked from one system to another, and I haven't even made it home yet, but this is like a new culture shock for me. So when I got to OSB, you know, I was kind of intrigued by the activities and the interactions, you know, and the pro-social behaviors, you know, amongst this particular population. And I wanted to get involved. I wanted to be a part of one of those conversations or one of those groups in the corner on the control floor or the crowd out here by the pile, because there was always something going on. And it wasn't about some negative stuff. It was always something going on, moving towards a program, a project, release, whatever it was. Somebody was involved in something. They were mentioning supporters' names and organizations that I never heard of and colleges. And I was like, well, wait a minute. So a guy embraced me, you know, a guy actually by the name of Earl Wilkins. He embraced me and said, hey, man, you know, it's good to see you here. And I remember him. I saw him a few times before I got incarcerated, but I remember him because his mom had raised my son. was starting to raise my son as I got incarcerated. My son was about one, and he embraced me, and we talked, and he, you know, kind of led me to some programs to get involved in. So I ended up getting involved with the Yuba Sasa Culture Club, which I now know that I didn't know then, but now I know now would change the whole course of my life and who I am as a human being, and enrich me culturally in ways that I didn't know, you know, and it started this trajectory on all the things that I'm doing today was from this club, the Yuba Sasa Culture Club. And I had got a part of that club as a member. And as a member, those guys put me on projects. Hey man, go over here and help out with the entertainment part, help out with the culture coordinators, you know, these small positions to kind of give me an idea on how this club works, you know, how the constitution governs this club and these, and what our mission and vision statement really means to not only just our culture, but to society as a whole. And by getting in that club, I was able to be privy. And I don't know if you want to consider it privy, but I was able to be privy to be able to meet all these different supporters that came out and supported this club. And the club's all located on the activities floor, and you see the hubbub and the activity and the networking going on up there. You got one club here, one club there, and supporters coming in, and they're introducing themselves to other clubs, and they're saying, hey, let's get a part of these programs, and let's get a part of this program. What is your club doing? And here I am. Now I'm involved. And one of the main things I can say with all the clubs up there, you know, of course, Yuba Sasa, most of all, is that we were all moving towards trying to find a way to either, you know, make life easier for us as, you know, inmates or convicts, whatever you want to call us in there. But also there was this collective fight. There was this collective energy in there about people going home. You know, it was always about, you know, transformative of justice. You know, there was criminal justice reform. You know, there was always talking about, you know, reentry, you know, getting guys housing, getting them some kind of job. And guys were constantly networking and getting resources out there because, you know, we had the African-American clubs, Latino clubs, Lakota clubs, the Asian clubs, and all the lifers. It was all these different clubs that had all their own networks, but they were all networking together. And it was a beautiful thing. And I wanted to be involved in this. And I found myself after a couple of years being in that club is I found a newfound hope. I knew I had 34 years, day for day, measure 11, I'm there. But being in that atmosphere actually gave me a sense of hope that maybe there's a possibility that I might have a chance to get home. Maybe if I talk to the right people, start getting involved in the right things, there's a possibility there. But that hope was instilled by looking at the hubbub, this atmosphere, you know, this interaction, this networking, these people out there just really caring about coming in here from the streets and coming in as supporters, caring about getting us home. You know, from the guys that organization's been here for a while to the college kids from Willamette University, University of Oregon, Linfield College, and you name it, they were coming in. And I met a lot of people. And one of the things that I'm most proud about is, you know, what kind of started me on my journey of discovery of self, you know, transforming who I was. I had a lot of talents in different areas, and I didn't really think they were talents because I was an audience of one. And that's when I had a guy said, hey man, you should enter the poetry, you know, and get on stage and do your thing to the club and represent, you know, from the culture standpoint. I was like, oh, okay. So I put together one of my pieces, and that was when I had met Karen James, you know, from K-Boo. And it was like, well, you know, she wants to interview you before you get on stage. I'm like, what? What you mean? You know, this is new to me, all this little, you know, but I almost felt like a like VIP status. I'm like, I'm gonna get an interview, I'm gonna do this, and this whole experience was it was exhilarating to me. You know what I mean? And I was trying to keep that poker face, but I was feeling good about this because if somebody cared about what I was getting ready to say and had real questions and was concerned, I mean, not really concerned, but just it was a genuine, hey, what are you doing? What are you gonna talk about? And it put me in a space, man, that I'd never been before because I was in that dark area, you know, where everything was just whatever. But she had asked me, you know, about the specific question she had asked me, what was my poem about and how does it resonate, you know, how would it resonate with the kids and with such, you know, different. And I was like, you know, I kind of went off the fly. But anyway, that was the start of me opening myself up to be a pro-social person, because I became, some people say I was playing anti-social, but some elders say social selective, you know, it's a combination of both. But anyway, that started me off. So being involved with the Yuba Sasa Club actually gave me an opportunity to, you know, to get more in tune with the supporters out there. And now all my creative juices and everything start to flowing. I'm coming up with ideas, you know, on how to help people and different organizations on the streets, domestic violence shelters, this center, or a kid that, you know, lost a limb to violence, or whatever the situation is. I wanted to be involved in all this stuff. You know, the compassion was coming back. You know what I'm saying? The empathy was coming. Everything was coming back. All my emotions were coming in. You know what I mean? I started to feel human. Because in Snake River, I just felt like I was being, you know, dehumanized. But here I started to feel human again. And eventually, as I started getting involved in programs, I worked my way up to be an executive body member of Yahoo Sasa. That allowed me executive privileges to be able to contact supporters myself now and be actively involved, create projects that would help other men. So we had our legal workshops. You know, it's the first time I've ever been in a legal workshop led by Yahuru that actually had, you know, federal attorneys coming in, judges coming in, district attorneys, and all this stuff was blowing my mind. I'm like, these people actually come, legislators, you know, senators. I mean, people were coming in here. I'm like, wow, this was amazing to me, you know? And so I was able to rub shoulders with these, what I call giants, you know what I'm saying? Because I had authority issues. And I was able to rub shoulders with these giants. In my eyes, they were giants. But then they treated me, as their equal. You know, they didn't look down upon me. They didn't treat me as being, you know, inferior. I didn't feel inferior to them. You know what I mean? And that's motivating me to work with them even more, because they were like, let's work together, you know, to help, you know, get these men out of here or get some of their time reduced. So there was this collective, like I said, this collective movement. So with the legal workshop, we were able to, you know, help a lot of situations, help a lot of guys, you know, in many ways to get home and bring a lot of the issues to the forefront. And then you had Michelle. They had the Transformative Justice Initiative, and she was coming in, you know, with those classes. And, you know, I was able to, you know, speak with her and involve myself in some of those areas, you know, which led me to eventually working with OASIS. These are a group of kids that came from the Transformative Justice Initiative originally, and they came and worked with Yahuru Sasa. We came up with this collective, you know, organization, OASIS, which is, you know, Oregon Against Slavery and Involuntary Servitude. And collectively, while I was incarcerated, we started to put this bill together, the SJR 10, which is a bill to remove the language of slavery, you know, from the Constitution, 13th Amendment. We wanted to remove this, you know, and we knew it was going to be a struggle. Well, we thought it was going to be a struggle, but what really kind of blew my mind is that it wasn't as bad as the introduction that we thought it was going to be, because you know, we're just a bunch of kids and convicts trying to put something together. Who's going to listen to us? You know what I mean? But the pulse of what's going on in society right now, we didn't realize there was more ears open than we thought, you know? So in the midst of this, I decided to write a clemency packet and, you know, throw caution to the wind, not knowing that all the things that I've done there, all the programs I'm involved in, all the networking and shoulder rubbing, actually being involved, I was so involved that I didn't even realize what my resume looked like. And when I decided to put this clemency together to write to Governor Kate Brown, here's a guy with 13 years left on his sentence from a 34-year sentence, 18 measure 11s, person-to-person crime. And here I am deciding, you know what, let me write Kate Brown. And as I start to write down all the things that I've accomplished in there, you know, not with a sense of arrogance, but almost with a sense of, I was in a state of humility, you know, humbleness, because I realized I had accomplished so much. But what is all this if she doesn't know who I am? Or people can't attest to who I am as a person. Then I realized when I reached out to people and I start to write down all the things that I've accomplished, I start to get all these support letters. I begin support letters from the guys inside, from support letters from different organizations from outside that came in and spoke with me. And I'm like, it started to blow my mind. I reached out to family and I was getting all this information, and I submitted it to Kate Brown, told her my story. You know, hey, Kate Brown, I'm dealing with the situation. You know, of course, I got my medical issues I'm fighting. You know what I'm saying? It's been a struggle. You know, I'm dealing with this Ramos, you know what I'm saying? Because I had the non-unanimous thing going in my Measure 11. So I'm in the midst of this. So I had to be transparent, because they tell you in clemency, don't talk about your legal problems. And I said, well, I have to be transparent with her. I don't want to seem manipulative or disingenuous. And when I presented this to her, I mean, you can only imagine the shock on my face when 6.5 months later, I got a phone call from Nathalene saying, hey, I just want to tell you that you got your clemency. Kate Brown was letting you go home. And of course, here I am now at home. You know, I've been out roughly, 35 days or something right about now. But within that time, everything that I've learned in there, every relationship I formed in there, and the collective responsibility that I'd have with being let out on this clemency. It was a shockwave across the entire Department of Corrections, because I was receiving letters and they were like, man, how did this happen? You got out? And they couldn't believe it, but I couldn't believe it. But I knew I had put in the work that at least to get a look or a nod in my direction, at least that at minimum. You know what I mean? Not to this magnitude. But getting out of a clemency has a lot of collective responsibility, because I know I carry a lot on my back, which I'm able to carry. It's not a big deal. But I know there are a lot of men were looking at me like, hey, man, the way you move and act out there is going to reflect upon every other decision she probably makes from this day forward. And me being an African-American and the pulse of what's going on with, you know, the talks about systemic racism and, you know, and just disenfranchisement, all these different things. And so when the first week I got out, I was filled with a lot of anxiety. I stayed home. I was next to my wife, and I sat there, and she said I was in bed a few times, and I was just shaking because I was still in shock that I was even out. And I knew what I wanted to do. I didn't want to lose sight of the energy that I had while I was in there, because people easily get out and forget what was going on there and go off on a dark path, or try to go chase an old dream or catch up with the times. And I didn't want to be caught up in that, you know, in that state. So I sat down for 2 weeks and I just collected myself. And I called maybe one person a day. I had many calls, but I can only handle one call a day, because every call was overwhelming for me. Hey, I'm home. I want to connect with you. Okay. And I sat back and, you know, and then I got up in the middle of the night and, you know, looked in the refrigerator to say, am I really home? Okay. Stared at it and came back. But the goal, I guess the, everything that I had in there, I knew that I told those guys, I made a commitment to them. I said, when I get out, one of the things I'm going to do first and foremost is ensure that this journey continues. You know, all the sponsors or people that came in and said they're going to help us in these fashions, I'm going to hold them accountable. And if not, I'm going to ask them to please step to the side, because these men are serious about their freedom. They're serious about getting home to their family. And if you can become a lip service, I'm going to call you on your stuff. You know what I mean? And I vowed to them that, because at the end of the day, I'm supposed to be doing another 13 years. So I'm going to use these years, you know what I'm saying, to help these men, you know what I'm saying, to be able to have that opportunity or a platform or be a voice or do it vicariously through me, so they're not forgotten, that they're always on the front line, they're always on the forefront of what's going on. So that being said, I was able for the first time, which was ironic, is I had a meeting, you know, with my group, you know, because I'm a board member with Oasis, and we had a meeting, and they were like, hey, TJ, you feel like testifying in front of the legislation or something? I'm like, what do you mean? They was like, yeah, we're having a Zoom meeting with legislators. We got Jeff Merkley, Kim Thatcher, Shamia Faye, and all these. I'm like, oh, whoa, these are the people I'm seeing on TV. So I'm naturally intimidated. I knew I had an agenda. And that's when we introduced the SJR, you know, 10, about the bill from the 13th Amendment. And I went in there and I spoke about it heavily, about how me being in the Yehuva Sasa Culture Club, and we're teaching cultural enrichment, but here we are as Black men incarcerated and Black men in his system, and you're telling us that you want us to rehabilitate. You know, we're talking about recidivism. You want us to, you know, talk about transformative justice. We're talking about criminal justice reform, all these things, reentry. But you got this language saying that, oh, by the way, we can treat you like slaves while you're incarcerated to work at this amount of money, and you're forced to do this, and Measure 17 backs us up. So I'm like, how do we feel as Black men and women sitting here incarcerated, and you're sitting there calling us slaves? But on the other hand, we got, you know, the governor talking about start supporting Black businesses, start celebrating Juneteenth, start doing this, you know, let's start this movement. But yet, all you politicians, you're sitting here talking about we have bipartisan support to help you guys in these sense, but you still got the word slavery in the Constitution. So how do you think that fits with us? Well, we're sitting here side by side with you when you have the power to remove that language.
For folks just tuning in, you are listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. And we're here with Takuma Jackson with several different projects. Right now we're talking about Oasis. And can you say the name again, and also how people can find out more about either the organization and or on the national front? Because that's a larger piece right there, right? To get slavery out of the 13th Amendment. Sounds like there's a lot of different national organizations. And then, of course, out here in the Pacific Northwest in Oregon, then we have Oasis, and then in tandem with I'm sure other community partners too. So yeah, can you talk more about that and how people can find out about it and plug in?
Yeah, absolutely. Oasis, we actually, like I said, it was pretty much started with a group of college kids and Yehuda Sasa. And of course, you know, this is a statewide bill that we're pushing. And one of the main people, and I'll say them, is Jordan Scott and Nikki Cates. They're my two go-to. They're the ones, they're spearheading this whole entire, you know, operation. We got our other guys, Riley, you know, on and the others. But I always go to Nikki Cates and Jordan Scott because they're on top of this. And we're definitely always looking for support, you know, some endorsements, you know, whether it's financial, whether it's a support letter, or whether it's a testimony, you know, towards this bill and this movement. Because at the end of the day, we want to let the healing begin, remove the language. Because as I said before, when you got the slavery language in there, and I'm sitting in here, it's like, okay, you want to work side by side with me. But to me, it's a mockery to Martin Luther King and a slap in the face to the Emancipation Proclamation. What are we doing here? You know? So, you know, for those who are interested in being involved in this project, you know, you can get at, like I mentioned, Jordan, and her email actually to the organization is J Scott, which is JSCHOTT at oasisprisoncoalition.org. And again, that's JSCHOTT at oasisprisoncoalition.org. And you can also go online. You know, we have information on there for those who want to join and get newsletters, you know, and like I say, or just you know, lend a hand, you know, lend a voice. So, you know, whatever you want to contribute, you know, all contributions is welcome. You know, if you just want to say, hey, I'm with you, you know, we accept that, you know, all the support, the better. So, you know, and that being said, I was actually, just last week, I was actually in another meeting, which was very interesting. I was invited to be in a meeting with Michelle Michaud, who actually runs the Transformative Initiatives. And I was able to speak, you know, in regards to, you know, the criminal justice reform and reentry from inside the walls and now, fortunately, outside. And I have a lot of respect for her because, you know, her whole movement is you know, helping prisoners in that aspect. And like I said, the Oasis group was some of her original, actually, the Anna is actually still vice president, one of our members, board members at the Oasis. She's actually still the vice president for the Transformative Justice Initiative. So that, you know, that's an exciting thing. And right now, when I got out, I was invited to a very special meeting as an introductory. And like I said, when I was invited to these meetings and people reaching out to me, it was surreal, because not once had I ever thought about, you know, I have my ideas about the NAACP, you know, what kind of movement they do, who they're really helping. And, you know, and I was just the outside looking in, kind of just talking out my butt. But when I finally got a hold of someone that I knew in there and they would say, hey, you need to come become a member. And I started to speak about, you know, the criminal justice reform, reentry, transformative justice. You know, they were like, hey, become a member. We'll get you in the membership. And we need you to be active in that area because that's an area that we're lacking at. We're lacking in. You know, it's there. But what it is, and I'm not saying they're lacking because it's intentional. What it is in COVID, there's a lot of people are not my color that are stepping up to the plate, or that have been recently incarcerated and understand what's going on the inside and coming out. So I'm able to give them certain perspectives, you know, from that standpoint, for being, you know, formerly incarcerated and now being actively involved in these type of organizations and these movements. So I've actually had an opportunity to, you know, sit in those meetings and become an active member. Now I'm a member of the NAACP and I'm putting together projects now, you know, as a presentation to the NAACP, so we can move towards that same intended goal and that same promise I made, criminal justice reform, transformative justice, and reentry. You know, that's what it's about. And if I'm to be transparent, I know that, you know, in my culture, you know, there's a disproportionate amount of us in prison. And I'm going to first and foremost work hard to get these black men out and these black women out. You know what I mean? I mean, first and foremost, no, me wrong, you know, I'm definitely, you know, I believe in black and brown relations, LGBTQ. It's not, you know, but this is my movement first, you know, and this is my movement first, and I'm committed to that. But yeah, moving forward, so while I was sitting there, I sat down with my wife and we came together and we were talking about, you know, what's important to her and what's important to me and what's important just for society and our culture. And because my wife is Native American, you know, she's Yakima, you know, Cowlitz or Squally. But the thing is, she has her MSW, you know, CADC3 and QMHP. So she deals with, in her current job, she deals with a lot of clinical assessments and mental health, domestic violence and these things. And I'm sitting over here like, I'm talking about criminal justice reform, reentry, you know, housing, getting guys, you know, housing when they get out, and, you know, and women. And I said, well, we're sitting here, you know, with this collective energy, you know, and with these backgrounds and these resources, why not create a platform, you know, ourselves, so we can reach out and be able to provide those resources, you know, for those same individuals. Because like I said, I can get busy working for many organizations and I give them my 100 every time. But we came up with the Mary Kayona Foundation. And the Mary Kayona Foundation is actually the name of her great grandmother, you know, from Yakima. And there's a major history behind her. If anybody, like, you know, with Google or going to look at history, there's a big history. And my wife is royalty. She's a princess. She was queened, there's a ceremony where they had named her Howlock Kawi, which is the spirit of the cougar. And it's in relation to her great grandmother, you know, Mary Kayona. She's recognized as royalty in that tribe. And sometimes I have to remind her of her status, you know, and hey, you know, you're a princess, you got this royalty, because a lot of times she gets overwhelmed, you know, what's going on around her. And it's empowering to her. And I sometimes have to remind her of her credentials. Like, you have a lot to offer. You got 28 years in this business. So I'm like, let's put this organization together. Let's make it happen. Me and you, get the family, we get all the kids on the board, and let's put our collective energy together, and let's be a part of what we've been doing with everybody else. So I reached out to a lot of people, you know, and we got our sponsorship, you know, we got our off the ground. She just, you know, recently last week put together, you know, our email, which is a proud thing. It's, you know, Mary Kayona Foundation at gmail.com. You know, so that was exciting for us. We're in the process of building the website. I gave my daughter, you know, the project of creating logo, and, you know, my son being a part of this creative process, and everybody's in, you know, it's a family thing, and we're all involved. And so what we're going to pretty much going to be offering, and of course the list will grow, but we're going to be focusing on the mental health, the substance abuse, you know, domestic violence. We're going to be dealing with, you know, like I said, the housing, the reentry, you know, trying to get guys, you know, jobs, and trying to develop homes for people to live in, you know, low income housing, etc. So we got a laundry list of things that we're working on and we're going to do.
So we'll have folks definitely look out for the next part two of this interview, when we talk about the Mary Kayona Foundation and all that it's going to be doing. I mean, it already is doing and will be, and how we can get in touch. People should definitely check out Oasis as well and support Huru Sasa at OSP. And we look forward to having you back on and hearing more about all this great work that you're doing. And folks have been listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Big thanks to our guests and all those great organizations, and also Prison Pipeline collective member Karen James for editing and production help. Free them all.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements.